chapter 9 now. Dr. Bob did chapter 8 last week. Now with chapter 9, I'm just going to give a little overview, and then we're going to jump in. I basically split this chapter called The Knowledge of God into 5 sections. The first section is people do possess powerful moral convictions. However, these moral convictions have no solid ground, at least with some people. The second one, which actually has 3 parts, is moral obligation. And the 3 parts are part A, the concept of moral obligation. Part B, the evolutionary theory. And part C, the problem of moral obligation. Then the third section, or third part of chapter 9, is the basis of our human rights. What can we base our human rights on? The fourth section is Annie Dillard and nature. Okay. Section 5 is the 2 options. First option, A. You can try to live as if there's no God. And part B, you can admit that you really know there is a living God. Now, to jump into our first section, section 1, Dr. Keller pretty much right off argues that young people do have powerful moral convictions. Some maybe old-timers or others may say, oh, kids these days, you know, they got no moral convictions, blah, blah, blah. And he pretty much says, in his experience in New York, working with the young people, they do have very strong or powerful moral convictions. For example, you know, one young atheist may think it is right for capital punishment to be abolished, while also believing that it is wrong for people in power to oppress the weak or poor. However, and here's the key, however, does our young atheist really have a basis for these convictions or claims? Now, if you have your book, mine's page 145, and because of how it's set up, I'll just read it to you. Here's what Dr. Keller has to say. People still have strong moral convictions, but unlike people in other times and places, they don't have any visible basis for why they find some things to be evil and other things good. It's almost like their moral intuitions are free-floating in midair, far off the ground. And he continues, I think that people will definitely go on holding to their beliefs in human dignity, even when conscious belief in God is gone. Why is this the case? I have a radical thesis. I think people in our culture know unavoidably that there is a God, but they are repressing what they know. So, let's go back to our young, passionate atheist and his powerful moral convictions. What I'm getting from Keller is that even though the young atheist denies the existence of God, and this gets a little tricky, it's actually his repression of God that gives him the basis for what he believes is wrong. Remember, I brought up that he believes it's wrong for people in power to oppress the weak or the poor. Now, please follow this. He claims there's no God, but because he actually knows there's a God, therefore he has a basis for his belief, and therefore he believes it strongly. So he does actually have a basis for his convictions, even though those convictions are based on, this is how I like to put it, a repression of God. His repression of the knowledge of God that he actually exists. Even though he represses this knowledge, it's actually this knowledge that gives him the foundation for his claims.
It's almost like he doesn't realize it.
Good point, yeah. Doesn't realize what That's he's what founding his convictions on. Yeah. Good way to put it. Section 2, with the concept of moral obligation, I'm going to state 2 facts and then we'll get back into the text. The first fact is this, that there is a transcendent moral order. The other fact, we treat some principles like they are ultimate standards or absolute standards. Now we will read what Dr. Keller has to say, and he'll give us, and I want you to pay attention to this part, he'll give us a definition of moral obligation as well as defend the two facts that I just stated. And in my book, it's page 146. If you have the different one, it's under the title, The Concept of Moral Obligation, right after the quote of Christian Smith, where it says, all human beings. And I'll just read this to you. Pay attention, especially to where he gives us the definition of moral obligation. All human beings have moral feelings. We call it a conscience. When considering doing something that we feel would be wrong, we tend to refrain. Our moral sense does not stop there, however. We also believe that there are standards that exist apart from us by which we evaluate moral feelings. And here's the definition. Moral obligation is a belief that some things ought not to be done regardless of how a person feels about them within herself, regardless of what the rest of her community and culture says, and regardless of whether it is in her self-interest or not. He continues. Though we have been taught that all moral values are relative to individuals and cultures, we can't live like that. In actual practice, we inevitably treat some principles as absolute standards by which we judge the behavior of those who do not share our values. One of the facts that I stated. What gives us the right to do that? If all moral beliefs are relative, nothing gives us the right. And this is so great. Yet, we can't stop it. People who laugh at the claim that there is a transcendent moral order do not think that racial genocide is just impractical or self-defeating, but that it is wrong. The Nazis who exterminated Jews may have claimed that they didn't feel it was immoral at all. We don't care. We don't care if they sincerely felt they were doing a service to humanity. They ought not to have done it. And he just puts that so well. Okay, so we're going to move now. We're in our second section. We're dealing with the moral obligation. There's the concept. And now we're going to be turning to the evolutionary theory. And we have some big questions here. Why do we treat some principles like ultimate standards or absolute standards? Why do we think ultimate standards exist outside of ourselves? Why do humans act like this? Why do they have this feeling of moral obligation? Why do they live in such a way that there are these standards that actually exist outside them? And, you know, what explains this? Well, this leads to part B of section 2 with the evolutionary theory. With science, they try to explain this concept of moral obligation. One claim from the scientific world for moral obligation is that it has been passed down to us. A long time ago, there were some people who were altruistic or unselfishly concerned for the welfare of others. These people had a better survival rate than those who were selfish. So, the unselfish genes survived being passed from one generation to another. This has led us to think that altruism is good or right, that it is an absolute standard that exists outside of ourselves. Today, we say unselfishness is a good thing, it's the right thing. Okay, so with the evolutionary theory, or with science, they try to explain how we got this, and this is one theory within the science community to explain moral obligation. Nick?
How... In the first place, would they have, you know, evolved into something that was, like, self-sacrificing, so to speak?
And that's what came to my mind.
Doesn't apply with the survival of the fittest whole
right.
theory.
Sort of, yeah. Sort of self-contradictory. There.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, let me give you my food. I
yeah.
die.
Yeah.
That's why Walt Disney made the Lion King.
To teach altruism in the circle of life.
Yes. The lions were very altruistic.
They did it quite well.
Yeah.
Quite convincing.
I've never met an altruistic lion.
No, you're going to have a problem.
I knew that all mountain lions were not nice.
Nature can be quite
I'm glad
ugly.
That you knew that.
Because they would hunt little kids.
Right. We're happy you knew that.
When they came up in the mountains and got Holly Berry's dogs that ate them up.
Yep.
So that mountain lion, they came down and ate her dog. She's on TV the first time we moved down here. I said, they could come from the mountain to eat you. I'm used to sleeping with a gun. It's hard to sleep without that gun. Come up here.
I know the feeling.
He said, I can't do it. I said, how's that supposed to be out here? I got to sleep with hammers now.
And leading to the weaknesses of this, we'll touch on what Dr. Keller writes, and then actually we'll kind of go with what Nick was bringing up. On page 148, underneath the evolutionary theory of moral obligation, this is the second paragraph. Here's what he says concerning this theory. There are, however, many flaws in this theory, and it has been given some devastating critiques. An individual self-sacrificing, altruistic behavior towards his or her blood kin might result in a greater survival rate for the individual's family or extended clan, and therefore result in a greater number of descendants with that person's genetic material. For evolutionary purposes, however, the opposite response, hostility to all people outside one's group, hate for everyone else, disgust for everyone else, should be just as widely considered moral and right behavior. Yet today we believe that sacrificing time, money, emotion, and even life, especially for someone not of our kind or tribe, is right. If we see a total stranger fall in the river, we jump in after him or feel guilty for not doing so. In fact, most people will feel the obligation to do so even if the person in the water is an enemy. How could that trait have come down by a process of natural selection? Such people would have been less likely to survive and pass on their genes. On the basis of strict evolutionary naturalism, the belief that everything about us is here because of a process of natural selection, that kind of altruism should have died out of the human race long ago. Instead, it is stronger than ever. And then, somewhat in lines with what Nick was bringing up, when I was looking on page 147 when this kind of theory is brought out, you kind of ask the question, well, where did the unselfish behavior come from in the first place? Why would these people so long ago, why did some people feel they had to care about others, that they had to be self-sacrificing? Where does that come from?
From the heart. You got to get up and do something for somebody. I've been doing it all my life. My grandmother told me that. The more I did, God is blessing me now for it. That's when they died, I gave this stuff away. And my great-grandmother told me, you're supposed to help people.
You should.
And they got stones too. You're supposed to. I got the stones. I was on the Candyman with what's his name? Sammy Davis Jr. They got stones. I got one by Elm by the Fifth Dimension. I heard it and I got so full. God want all of us to help each other, because the more we help each other, we get blessed and we all relatives. And that's the way He wanted.
Oh, I agree.
That's like you get tired of something. Well, I got that all my clothes. I gave away. My mother died. I gave all my high school clothes away. They said they knew. That's all right. I gave all away because I was going to give me some more. I was going back to Chicago. What you wear in the country, you can't wear in the city. It don't look right.
With that, I definitely agree. So those are some of the weaknesses with this. But let's continue with the weakness of science, or maybe a better way to put it is this. The inabilities of, and this is kind of funny, modern science. Now, what am I getting at here? Or put better, what is Dr. Schaefer getting at here? In his book, Escape from Reason, and this is excellent what he brings up.
We have to start.
Let me make sure I have the right part. 229. Here's what Dr. Schaefer says. We're talking about science. We're talking about the evolutionary theory. And here's what he gives us. Very interesting stuff. The earlier scientists believed in the uniformity of natural causes. What they did not believe in was the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. Is there an echo in here?
Yeah.
Randy C. will really appreciate this. He will. Okay, here it is. What they did not believe in was the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. That little phrase makes all the difference in the world. It makes the difference between natural science and a science that is rooted in naturalistic philosophy. It makes all the difference between what I would call modern science and what I would call modern science. It is important to notice that this is not a failing of science as a science. Science itself is not the problem. But rather that the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system has become the dominant philosophy among scientists. And then moving along with this thought, again, this comes from Escape from Reason. And once again, what we're talking about are the inabilities of modern science, the problems, the weaknesses. And here's what he brings out concerning this type of scientific philosophy. Here we go. The second possible answer in the area of existence is that all that now is had an impersonal beginning. This impersonality may be mass, energy, or motion, but they are all impersonal. And all equally impersonal. So it makes no basic philosophic difference which of them you begin with. Many modern men have implied that because they are beginning with energy particles rather than old-fashioned mass, they have a better answer. Salvador Dali did this as he moved from his
surrealistic
period into his new mysticism. But such men do not have a better answer. It is still impersonal. Energy is just as impersonal as mass or motion. As soon as you accept the impersonal beginning of all things, that's the thing, of all things, you are faced with some form of reductionism. Reductionism argues that everything which exists, from the stars to man himself, is finally to be understood by reducing it to the original impersonal factor or factors. Please bear with me. This is what I'm getting at with the inability of modern science. The great problem with beginning with the impersonal is to find any meaning for the particulars. A particular is an individual factor, any individual thing, the separate parts of the whole. A drop of water is a particular, and so is a man. If we begin with the impersonal, then how do any of the particulars that now exist, including man, have any meaning, any significance? Nobody has given us an answer to that. In all the history of philosophical thought, whether from the East or the West, no one has given us an adequate answer. But here's the one I really want to bank on right here. Beginning with the impersonal, everything, including man, must be explained in terms of the impersonal plus time plus chance. Do not let anyone divert your mind at this point. There are no other factors in the formula because there are no other factors that exist. If we begin with an impersonal, we cannot then have some form of teleological concept. No one has ever demonstrated how time plus chance, beginning with an impersonal, can produce the needed complexity of the universe, and here it is, let alone the personality of man. No one has given us a clue to this. Yes?
I was reading something by Del Tackett this last week, and he was comparing Islam with Christianity. Islam, false religion, has created a God that is impersonal.
Mm.
not a social unit. He's one, there is no other. And so the Muslims never expect any kind of a personal relationship with God, and it also affects the way their religion is, because they have to go back to the 7th century in order to have a valid representation of Islam. Because God has revealed to us that He is a Trinity. He's a community. There's a personal relationship there within the Godhead that has always been perfect. And He imprinted that upon our universe and upon us. And the personality that we have, the interpersonal relationships, the community, are a reflection of His character because of who He is. And so therefore, we can enter into a personal relationship with Him because that's the way He exists.
Mm. Very good point. Very good.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that we can do that.
And maybe Randy can correct me on this, but the ancient Jews, they didn't have a concept of a personal relationship with God because they were so hung up on, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And they never factored in the other Old Testament scriptures that seem to indicate that there is a spirit and there's a son, that there is a triune relationship there.
But I would say that's true with respect to Jews who did not understand their own scriptures and
right.
did not understand the revelation of God.
Right.
So that by the time of Jesus' day, those who really did not have a true understanding, what we call Judaism as opposed to true belief,
right.
you're right. But if you read through the Old Testament, one of the things that does come out, for the scriptures themselves say this and believing Jews recognize this, is God is personal. And the way this is revealed in the Old Testament is God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That God is the God who's still the God of these persons. Even though these persons have died, God is still their God. So He exists, they exist, they still continue. But the main idea there, instead of, quote, personal relationship, the main idea in the Old Testament is covenant. That what defines a personal relationship is, in fact, a covenant. And covenants can only ultimately really exist between persons. Symbolically, you can have a covenant with creation. But that's God's promise to do things in a particular way, but that's a promise even within Himself. But covenants are between persons. So that's essentially what defines that personality and personhood of God in the Old Testament.
Very good. Very good. Okay, connection with personal, impersonal. Real quick, what I'm trying to get at, if you were struggling following along with Schaefer, or with my reading of Schaefer, is basically this. We have the impersonal, we got time, we got chance. How do we go from that to the personality of man? Who can provide me a good argument that's going to give us the personality of man? And I think within the Christian communities, especially even with Dr. Sproul, he'll say this cannot be answered with an evolutionary theory atheistic evolutionary theory perspective of our world. It's quite a damaging argument. It's a good argument to have in the resources of your mind. Okay? Now, I'm connecting this with Dr. Keller. My quick addition has led to this. One, the science Keller brings up in this part of the book is actually a science that is rooted in naturalistic philosophies. Okay, Randy will often mention scientists. They're great scientists. However, often they make poor philosophers. Second, it is this philosophy that not only, here I'm kind of repeating myself, but bear with me. It is this philosophy that not only cannot explain man's moral obligation, what we talked about earlier, but also cannot explain man's personality. And to extend from that, Schaefer also brought up, it can't explain man's significance, or it doesn't give any basis for man being significant. Man is, and I like how they put it, because it's just so bold, man is zero. Man is a zero. Moving on to the third part within our second section is the problem of moral obligation. This gets quite interesting. The problem of moral obligation, I was going to pick on Nancy, but because she's not here, I'm going to pick on Julie. So I'm just trading the name. Julie has suddenly become a committed faithful follower of cultural relativism, which basically means that she does not put her views over those of a totally different culture. She's not going to force people to think or live the way that she lives. Now, as a faithful follower, she travels around the world and comes across different cultures. She is a world traveler, having a wonderful time spending Randy's money, too.
She didn't get far out of Bakersfield.
That's a Barstow.
I don't even know where that is.
You don't want to know. And in one culture, she discovers that women are being treated very poorly. Very poorly. Abused, mistreated. It's really ugly, and it is really sad. Now, Julie wants to help these women, and she definitely wants this atrocity to stop altogether, but she runs into a major problem, a major personal crisis. How can she tell this society how to live and treat others when her own belief forbids her from doing so? How can she help these women without violating cultural relativism? Okay. Now, don't think this little story is unrealistic or impossible. In fact, if you turn in your book, getting back to the text of Dr. Keller, on page 149, right underneath the problem of moral obligation, this is quite fascinating, what is brought up, and I'm reading where it says, anthropologists continue. Okay? I believe this was written by a lady named Carolyn. Anthropologists continue to express strong support for cultural relativism. One of the most contentious issues arises from the fundamental question, what authority do we Westerners, in this case Julie, have to impose our own concept of universal rights on the rest of humanity? But the cultural relativist argument is often used by repressive governments to deflect international criticism or of their abuse of their citizens. I believe that we should not let the concept of relativism stop us from using national and international forums to explain ways to protect the lives and dignity of people in every culture. When there is a choice between defending human rights and defending cultural relativism, anthropologists should choose to protect and promote human rights. We cannot just be bystanders. And here's what Keller says about this quote. The author, in this case Carolyn, poses a difficult question. This is the dilemma Julie's going through. If all cultures are relative, then so is the idea of universal human rights. So how can I decide to impose my values on this culture? But she doesn't answer her own question. She has just said that her charge of oppression is based on a Western concept of individual freedom, but she has no answer for this conundrum. She simply declares that women are being oppressed and she feels she has to stop it. We have to bring our Western values to these other nations. Our values are better than theirs, period.
Amen.
Now, considering cultural relativism or moral relativism, we are now going to turn to, and I've been wanting to get to this guy, and I can finally pull it out, because at the very beginning I mentioned him, and I haven't brought him up at all, and that is our dear friend J.P. Moreland. Okay, in his book, Love Your God With All Your Mind, and this is excellent what he does. First of all, a top-rate mind, great thinker. I'm sure Randy would highly recommend some of his works, although read it with caution. But as far as getting you to think and to argue and to reason, masterful, masterful mind. And in his book, now we're talking about cultural relativism, we're talking about moral relativism, the problems. Here's what Dr. Moreland has to say. He's actually going to bring up five critiques or five objections to moral relativism. However, we're going to only go into three. But before we get to that, here's what he says, or here's what he writes. What is moral relativism? First, what is it? Moral relativism is widely espoused in this country, the U.S. This moral thesis holds that everyone ought to act in accordance with the agent's own society's code, or perhaps with the agent's own personal code. What is right for one society is not necessarily right for another. For example, Society A may have in its code adultery is morally permissible, and Society B may have adultery is morally forbidden. In this case, adultery is permissible for members of A and forbidden for those in B. Put differently, moral relativism implies that moral propositions are not simply true or false. This is interesting. Rather, the truth values, true or false, of moral principles themselves are relative to the beliefs of a given culture. For example, murder is wrong is not true, plain, and simple. It is, quote-unquote, true for cultural A, but perhaps, quote-unquote, false for cultural B. The point here is not just that there is a certain relativity in the application of moral principles. For example, two cultures could both hold that one should maintain sexual fidelity in marriage, but apply this differently due to factual differences about what counts as a marriage. For example, one wife or several wives. Factual diversity can lead to differences in the way a moral rule is applied. And it continues. Moral relativism goes beyond this type of diversity and asserts that the truth values of moral principles themselves are relative to a given culture. For example, whether or not one ought to maintain sexual fidelity could be true relative to one culture and false relative to another culture. There is a difference between individual moral relativism and cultural moral relativism. And for this, for the individual, he calls it subjectivism, and for the cultural, he calls it conventionalism. So with the subjectivism, says the truth of moral rules is relative to the beliefs of each individual. Conventionalism makes moral truth relative to entire cultures or societies. Now, let's get to our objections of this moral relativism or this cultural relativism, the crisis that Julie's in. He mentions five. We will do three. Here they are. Because of the seriousness of the criticism raised against it, and this is interesting, the majority, okay, this isn't most. I mean, well, this is most. The majority of moral philosophers and theologians do not embrace moral relativism. Okay, so the great thinkers of our day may not actually be moral relativists, even though we may say, oh, it's so big in our country. There may be a lot of U.S., United States intellectuals that see the problems with it and therefore reject it. So don't think that just everybody believes this, especially in the intellectual community. Okay, now with the objections, the first one. First, it is difficult to define what a society is, or to specify in a given case what the relevant society is. Consider societies A and B above. If a man from A has extramarital sex with a woman from B in a hotel in a third society, C, which holds a different view from either, A or B, which is the relevant society for determining whether the act was right or wrong? That's his first objection.
C. Go with C.
Second one. Second, a related objection is the fact that we are often simultaneously a member of several different societies that may hold different moral values. Our nuclear family, our extended family, our neighborhood, school, church, or social clubs, our place of employment, our town, state, country, and the international community. Which society is the relevant one? What if I am simultaneously a member of two societies, and one holds and one allows, but the other forbids a certain moral action? What do I do in this case?
Move to Utah.
I guess it could be.
I mean, you can look at the United States now, okay? California says it's legal to have marijuana medicinal. Federal government says it's illegal. So all of these places that are opened up in Bakersfield, the feds keep coming and busting.
Yeah, at the state level, it's completely fine.
Yes.
So therefore, the ones giving out the drug, are they morally wrong or morally right in doing so in California?
Right.
Good point.
Well, what about...
No, there are no buds. No. Go ahead.
The Mormons and polygamy in Utah.
Within their religion or culture, it's acceptable, or I don't know if it's officially acceptable. Yeah. Used to be.
Sex of it.
It's officially not acceptable.
Hmm.
Yeah, it used to be. In order to get statehood, they had to give it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, within
sex.
Different sex.
Splinter groups of Mormonism.
Offshoot cults.
Right.
Right. S-E-C-T-S.
Yeah, so what is a young man or a young woman supposed to do? What choice are they supposed to make when it comes when they're put under these types of pressures? It would become paralyzing if you were to really consider all of the things. Oh, they say do this, they say do that, they say do this. I mean, you'd become paralyzed.
We all grow up in families like that. I mean, I wouldn't even want to tell you some of the moral
contradictions
that I grew up with, you know, that were happening in my home.
I could tell you about them, though.
That were, you know, completely and morally wrong in society. You know, when you're growing up as a child, seeing these things happen, and, you know, you get that confusion. You don't even have to go statewide. You know, we can just talk about, you know, in individual homes. So.
Very good.
Take a look at what's going on in this country now. You've got certain states that accept homosexual marriage. Other states don't accept it. So what happens when somebody from a state that accepts homosexual marriage moves to a state that
doesn't accept
homosexual marriage? How do they relate?
That's a
good point. Very good point.
Mine is one around me. I speak to that. Hi, my sister. Hi, you know, she's smoking like a man. She's smoking like a man. She works at a deli. And then I saw the man with the piece of man came. I saw this great big old lady that went back to the garbage can and came back. She's coming out taking the smoke and she's doing like a man do to a woman. And I saw her. And she know I saw her. So she gonna get down because she know I'm a pastor. So I went the other way, I don't speak to her no more. When she see me, she started nervous. She know I saw her. She got a great big lady. She got locked up in there. She's like, she weighed 250 pounds. And she a little skinny, so they white. So I told Linda, she says, one on this side, too. I said, karate time. I don't trust them.
Get out the hammer.
But wait a minute. One of my friends, this is important. I was going to whole age of school, and she only had one little girl, and she was jumping on my kids. She said, Mom, she just making stuff like a little wild puppy. I said, well, Ann, why don't you have another baby? That girl went off on me. She older than me, she tall. And then when she finally come out, she's crying with hysteria. She said she got raped while she's pregnant by a woman. I said, oh, shoot, I'm ready now. I go in the bathroom, I'm like, boys in the hood. I went to install, the lady came in, I looked at her, and she saw, she ran out of there, because she saw I wasn't handicapped. I did boys in the hood before Martin and them did it. When I was little, my mama ever did, because I gave her to take my milk money. She said, come here again, whoop. So I twisted the egg, I dumped it, and turned, I flushed it. I said, don't you tell me. She told me I was little or something. And she came in there, she didn't mess with me no more. My mom said, you get it, I got it. So when Martin Miller did, I started laughing. I said, that's me.
You know, Beverly makes a good point about, well, I don't know if it's good, but she said something about mind your own business. The problem with that is when you mind your own business, these activist groups come in, and they impose their value systems on you, and you have to go along with them. And point in fact is a hate crimes bill that's going on now. You know, if that gets passed, preachers in Christian churches may not be able to talk against homosexuality without being imprisoned for their views.
Yeah. Well, they say, I went to that other church where I came to y'all, and they said, we ain't supposed to get in too much of nothing, because we can't get
so
in trouble.
So, minding your own business doesn't necessarily
Well, they're not work. Minding their own business.
Oh, they're not going to.
Right.
Because their
but I mean, I'm just saying
their
that.
Whole belief system is to destroy any kind of religious belief system whatsoever.
I agree.
As long as it's not theirs.
Very good.
But I talk to the men, so I don't talk to the ladies.
Oh, yeah. The third objection that Moreland brings out to moral relativism or cultural relativism is this. Third, moral relativism suffers from a problem known as the reform... This is great. Pay attention. This is good. Known as the reformer's dilemma. Okay? The reformer's dilemma. If normative relativism is true, then it is logically impossible for a society to have a virtuous moral reformer like Jesus Christ, Gandhi, or Martin Luther King Jr. Why? Moral reformers are members of a society who stand outside that society's code and pronounce a need for reform and change in that code. However, if an act is right, if and only if it is in keeping with a given society's code, then the moral reformer himself is by definition an immoral person. For his views that are at odds with those of his society, moral reformers must always be wrong because they go against the code of their society. Imagine today saying what Martin Luther King Jr. did was wrong. He's immoral. He was a horrible man because he went against what society believed at that time. I mean, people would be outraged, and rightly so. So that's the third critique of moral relativism. Recommend it. It's not the deepest read. It's more of an encouragement read, and obviously a great mind and a great defender of Christian. J.P. Moreland. He's down at
I thought you kept saying Morgan.
Oh,
no.
No, J.P. Moreland. He's a Moreland.
Moreland.
Yeah. He's a professor at a Talbot Seminary, I believe. And my brother, I think, is right now going there, and I keep encouraging me. I don't know if he has. And Nate, if you're listening, this is for you. He needs to sit under this man. This guy, excellent. Francesca and I both heard him speak, and he's clear. He's intelligent. He's a man who is study and debates a lot. Great thinker. Now, we're going to move into our third section, and this is where it gets fun, because it's going to be biography time.
What has it been to up till now?
Horrible. With section three, we have the difficult issue of human rights. Okay? What are human rights? What are we going to base them on? Especially if there's no God. However, before we consider that, if we actually even do consider that, we are going to be going on a little biographical journey. This man's name was mentioned in chapter 8 from Dr. Bob. And in this present chapter, and the man's name is, and may the French forgive me, I'll just say it this way, Jean-Paul Sartre. Okay?
Jean-Paul.
Yeah.
Jean-Paul.
I said I'm not even going to go there. Okay, Jean-Paul Sartre. Okay? That's the way I'm going to deliver it. Frenchies, forgive me.
Frenchies.
Okay, now, little biographical journey. Very interesting man.
Can you see his name?
What's in a name? What's in the pronunciation of a name? He was born in 1905, and he actually died in 1980. Okay, so he's very recent. He was, and Randy can correct me if I'm wrong, an atheistic, existentialistic philosopher, French philosopher. And his book, Nausea, which Dr. Keller quotes from in Chapter 8, was actually his first novel. And Dr. Sproul informs us that this novel is about the human predicament. And continuing with Dr. Sproul's thoughts on Sartre, here's what he says about the French philosopher. And I want you to pay attention and notice what Sartre says. Remember, we're talking about man, his dilemma, moral obligation, cultural relativism. I want you to notice what Sartre says about man and freedom. Okay, that's the first one, man and freedom, and connect it to moral obligation. In his book, and I do recommend this as well, The Consequences of Ideas. Here's what Dr. Sproul writes. And this, of course, is about Sartre. During World War II, Sartre became active in the French resistance, for which the Germans made him a prisoner of war. While in prison, he continued to study and expound on Heidegger's philosophy. He was also heavily influenced by Marxism, but he never joined the Communist Party. When he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, the guy's brilliant. When he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, he refused to accept the reward on the grounds that it would turn him into an institution. Since Sartre believes there is no God, he believes there is no prior idea for human beings, no design or purpose for them. There is no human essence or nature to which individual humans correspond or conform. Let me go with this. In the case of man, says Sartre, let me skip that section. I can't mark this book, it's not mine. Okay, continuing. For Sartre, and here's where we come to the idea of freedom. For Sartre, it is not so much that man has freedom as that human existence is freedom. His notion of freedom encompasses the idea of moral autonomy. Man is not subject to objective rules. No norms govern his behavior. Sartre insists on such autonomy as a consequence of his atheism. Like Heidegger, Sartre speaks of the human sense of being abandoned in the universe. Out of the resulting anxiety, man is, as it were, forced to be free. Man must choose for himself what he will become. For Sartre, freedom is freedom from morality. Freedom must embrace what is disgusting. At one point, Sartre describes man as a useless passion. This description identifies two distinct aspects of human existence. First, man is a being who feels and cares. He has passion, and all of us can attest to that. People care. We normally associate people with some goal. We have a passion for something. But second, man's passion is useless. It is futile and meaningless. And the more I consider my cares and feelings to be futile, the greater my sense of futility. This futility fuels the anxiety that is connected to freedom. Freedom is a given of my existence. I must be free. I am not free not to be free. Freedom is a burden that can crush the human spirit. And I want you to pay attention, because Sproul then goes into a personal story, a personal narrative, and it's quite fascinating. While in seminary, this is Dr. Sproul, while in seminary, I was walking through the East Liberty section of Pittsburgh on a Saturday evening. As I passed a jewelry store, a man ran out the door and collided with me. I grabbed him so that neither of us would fall to the ground. As I held him in my grasp, he looked me in the eye and meekly said, "I surrender." At that moment, a woman ran out of the store shouting, "Stop, thief!" The man, unarmed, had just robbed the jewelry store. While he waited calmly, notice that, he speaks softly and he waits calmly, the police arrived to take him into custody. The following day, I met one of the arresting officers and asked him about the man I had, quote-unquote, captured. The officer explained that the robber had been released from jail the previous day and had not wanted to leave. He committed a new crime, making sure that he was captured so that he could return to the safety and security of his jail cell. In the jail, he had 3 meals a day and a bed to sleep in. This was a man who could not dare to be free. The anxiety that attends freedom was too much for him. He was the quintessential inauthentic man.
Now, a little personal story in connection with this. I went over to Randy's house to do work. Although what I accomplished, I would not identify or classify as work. Randy and I like to talk.
Really?
And I went over there, and I kind of, not going over there to make a confession, but this just kind of came out of me. And it's actually connected, and I'm going to bring up his name again, with John Grisham. But this book this time is with The Chamber. And in this book, we find a man that's on death row. And I confess to Randy, you know, when I was reading this novel, I could not help but be envious of the man on death row. I was actually jealous of his situation. He had all his needs. He had his typewriter to write. He was fed. He was protected. He didn't have to decide. He did not have to be free, because there is great anxiety with freedom. And my desire, if I have this correct, according to the Sartre, that desire I had, that feeling would be labeled an authentic man.
Say, will you?
Actually, yes, 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 very true. I agree.
But there's neither right or wrong there. That's not a...
Sartre would say, well, I don't know.
I don't think you could apply a moral, you know, yes, it's right. To feel that way? Right.
That's not the conclusion Luke and I came to.
We conclude that I should go to jail and that I should have a good life. And Francesca was sweet for a time.
But the fear of freedom, I'm saying, I don't think you can label that a right or a wrong. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Because you kind of labeled it.
Because she's still the cultural relativist.
Oh, yes. I'm going to always turn to you for comfort.
Free me from
you,
that.
You
yet.
Can't, you know, yeah. Label me right or wrong in any situation.
There
I love being around you. Beverly, and then there's one part we just have enough time that I want to conclude with, and then we get to Pilgrim's Progress, so I want to conclude with that. But Beverly, real quick.
Okay, the police told me that you talked about not going to jail because they used them like going to little girls. But lipstick on and you get sex with molested a bit. So I worked at a hospital school in Chicago, and they told me that. So you don't want to go to jail.
No, yeah, it can be a very ugly place.
That's why we'll take freedom.
Right. So, I debated about sharing that, but moving on. Let's finally take one more look at Sartre before we get to Pilgrim's Progress. And again, let's turn to Escape from Reason with Dr. Schaefer and see what he says about the man's thoughts. Here's what he has to say about Sartre in his book, again, Escape from Reason. First, Jean-Paul Sartre. Rationally, the universe is absurd, and you must try to authenticate yourself. How? By authenticating, in my case, how am I going to do this? I got to get away from this label of inauthentic man. What can I do, Sartre? Tell me. By authenticating yourself by an act of will. So if you are driving along the street and see someone in the pouring rain, you stop your car, pick him up, and give him a lift. It is absurd. What does it matter? He is nothing. The situation is nothing. But you have authenticated yourself by an act of the will. But the difficulty is that authentication has no rational or logical content. All directions of an act of the will are equal. Therefore, similarly, if you are driving along and see the man in the rain, speed up your car
and run over.
Yep, and knock him down. Exactly, and knock him down. You have, in an equal measure, authenticated your will. Do you understand? If you do, cry for modern man in such a hopeless situation. Highly recommend Schaefer. Very clear. And to conclude with, let's turn back to Dr. Keller. Randy, do I have time? Is this okay?
Sure.
Okay.
2-minute warning.
Okay, to conclude with Dr. Keller, mine's 157. And here's what we find. We all live as if it is better to seek peace instead of war, to tell the truth instead of lying, to care and nurture rather than to destroy. We believe that these choices are not pointless, that it matters which way we choose to live. Remember with Sartre, it doesn't matter. Just authenticate yourself. Choose. Yet if the cosmic bench, meaning there is no God, yet if the cosmic bench is truly empty, then who says that one choice is better than the others? We can argue about it, but it's just pointless arguing, endless litigation. If the bench is truly empty, then the whole span of human civilization, even if it lasts a few million years, will be just an infinitesimally brief spark in relation to the oceans of dead time that precede it, and will follow it, and will follow it, and will follow it, and will follow it. There will be no one around to remember any of it. Whether we are loving or cruel in the end would make no difference at all. Once we realize this situation, this is section 5, remember I brought the two options. We're going to hit the first one. Once we realize this situation, there are two options. One is that we can simply refuse to think out the implications of all of this. We won't think about it. We can hold on to our intellectual belief in an empty bench and yet live as if our choices are meaningful and as if there is a difference between love and cruelty. How would we do that? A cynic might say that this is a way of having one's cake and eating it too. That is, and this is fascinating, that is, you get the benefit of having a God without the cost of following him. But there is no integrity in that. And let's say you're arguing with a man who believes that there is no God, and you basically point out this idea, look, if you're going to, you know, act as if God exists and yet not follow him, basically you're in a position of that lacks integrity. Now, of course, the man could respond to you, I don't care. That's nice. But what I would encourage you to do, there's several options you could take, but one is this, is make sure you point that out to him. Make sure it's clear to him of his position. Because perhaps over time, and Lord willing, this will cause him to doubt. This will bring on turmoil. This will bring on anxiety. This will bring on dread. And then perhaps, Lord willing, it will bring on something else. The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, we open up with a man that is in a state of despair, anxiety, dread, hopelessness. I'm always talking about these things. I mean, yeah. Well, we would have a great conversation, as Randy said, if I knew French.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't. I can't blame him. Here's what. I wouldn't talk to him then. Here's the state we find the man, and hopefully, by you arguing with someone in an intelligent, loving way, it will force that person eventually to come into this position, which is actually, in one sense, not horrible, and yet at the same time, dreadful, dreadfully horrible. Here's what we have. Unable to contain himself any longer, he broke out with a sorrowful cry, saying, "What shall I do?" He went home in this state of mind, but restrained himself as long as he could so his wife and children would not notice his distress. Yet he could not be silent long because his troubled feeling was getting worse. He finally revealed to his wife and children what was going on in his mind, saying, "Oh, my dear wife and children, I am suffering from inner turmoil because of a burden that lays heavy upon me. And what's worse, I've been reliably informed that our city will be burned with fire from heaven. In that fearful disaster, I with you, my wife, and you, my sweet children, will come to a miserable ruin unless some way of escape, which as yet I do not see, may be found by which we may be delivered." His family members were deeply troubled at this declaration, not because they believed what he told them, but because they thought some form of insanity had gotten into his head. Therefore, since it was nearing nightfall and hoping that sleep would settle his brain, they quickly got him to bed. But the night was as troublesome to him as the day. And for that reason, instead of sleeping, he spent it sighing and weeping. When morning came, they wanted to know how he was, and he told them, worse and worse. He started talking to them again, but they began to harden to his words. They thought they might be able to drive away his insanity by harsh and bad-tempered behavior toward him. Sometimes they would make fun of him. Sometimes they would make fun of him, at other times they would criticize him, and sometimes they would simply ignore him. Because of this, he began to withdraw from them to his bedroom and to pray for them, pity them, and comfort his own misery. He would also walk by himself in the field, sometimes reading and sometimes praying. He spent his time doing things for several days. Now I saw once, when he was walking in the fields, that he was, as was often the case, reading in his book, the Bible. He was greatly distressed in his mind, and as he read, he burst out as he had done before, crying, "What must I do to be saved?" Now, as you progress through the story, we come to something wonderful, and hopefully the person you talk to will reach this state, Lord willing. Going with the same man, Christian, here's what eventually happens in our story. So he ran until he came to a place somewhat elevated. Upon that place stood a cross, and below at the bottom there was a tomb. I saw in my dream that just as Christian came up to the cross, his burden came loose from his shoulders and fell off his back. It began to tumble and continue to do so until it came to the mouth of the tomb. It then fell into the tomb, and I saw it no more. Then Christian was glad and relieved, and he said with a joyful heart, "He has given me rest from sorrow and life through his death." Then he stood still a while to look and wonder, for he was very surprised that the sight of the cross should ease him of his burden in such a way. He looked therefore and looked again, even until the springs in his head sent waters flowing down his cheeks. Now, as Christian stood looking and weeping, three shining ones came to him and greeted him with, "Peace be to you." The first said to him, "Your sins are forgiven."
Amen.
Absolutely. A big amen. And hopefully... I had to throw in some, you know, something to liven it up. But yeah. What a joyous conclusion. What a joyous conclusion. Reverend, if you would please lead us in
prayer. Father, thank you. Thank you so much that to all these philosophies that take us to despair, your gospel is the wonderful balm of Gilead. Thank you for giving us Jesus in his name.